The Duke's throat tightened. Unable to speak, his only response was to pull Jessica into his arms and hold her tightly. The fact that any family in the Imperium could deploy its atomics to destroy the planetary bases of 50 or more great houses need not concern us overmuch. It is a situation we can hold in check, if we remain strong enough. Emperor Fondil III. In light of the importance of the day's announcement, Shaddam IV had commanded that the Golden Lion throne be moved back into the opulent Imperial Audience Chamber. Wearing a carmine robe, he sat on the heavy block of carved crystal, looking and feeling truly regal as he anticipated the reaction of the Landsrad. After this, the unruly houses will know they ignore me at their peril. From behind the closed doors that led into the vast room, he could hear the murmur of impatient representatives who had been summoned here. He couldn't wait to see their faces when they learned what he had done to Zanavar. Shaddam's pomaded red hair glistened beneath the glow globes. He took a long drink of spice coffee from a delicate china cup, studied the fine patterns hand-printed on its surface. The precious cup would be destroyed, like everything on Zanavar. He formed his powdered face into a terrible paternal frown. He would not smile today, no matter how pleased he felt. Emerging from one of the secret corridors, Lady Anirul entered the audience chamber, her chin held high. She walked directly toward the throne, undaunted by the magisterial decor. Shaddam muttered under his breath, cursing his lack of foresight for not closing off all entrances to the room. He would have to discuss the matter with Chamberlain Redondo. My husband and Emperor. She approached the base of the dais and gazed up at the legendary throne. Before you begin, there is a matter I must discuss with you. Anirul's bronze-brown hair was freshly coiffed and secured by a golden clasp. Do you know the significance of this year? Shaddam wondered what schemes the Bene Gesserit had developed behind his back. Why, it is 10-175. If you cannot consult an imperial calendar for yourself, one of my courtiers could easily have informed you of the date. Now be about your business, as I have an important announcement to make. Anirul stood unruffled. It is a centenary, marking the death of your father's second wife, Yvette Hagal Corino. The Emperor's eyebrows shifted as he tried to follow her line of thought. Damn her, what has this to do with my overwhelming success on Zanavar? If that is true, we have all year to celebrate this anniversary. Today I have a decree to announce to the Landsrad. His meddling wife would not be swayed. What do you know of Yvette? Why do women persist in matters of little import at the moment of greatest inconvenience? I have no time for a family history quiz. But under her steady, doe-eyed stare, he pondered for a moment, while glancing at the ornate Ixion chrono on the wall. The representatives would never expect him to begin on time anyway. Yvette died years before I was born. Since she was not my mother, I never bothered much with her. There must be film books in the Imperial Library if you would like to learn. During his long reign, your father had four wives, and he permitted only Yvette to sit beside him on a throne of her own. It is said that she was the only noble woman he ever truly loved. Love? What does that have to do with imperial marriages? Apparently, my father also had a deep affection for one of his concubines, but he didn't realize it until she decided to marry Dominic Vernius. He scowled. Are you trying to draw comparisons? Do you want me to profess my affection for you? What sort of question are you asking? It is a wife's question. It is also a husband's question. Anirul waited at the base of the dais, still looking up at him. I want my own throne in here, beside yours, Shaddam, as your father had for his favorite wife. The Emperor slurped half of his spice coffee to calm himself. Another throne in here? Though he'd assigned his Sardaukar spies to watch Anirul, they had not found anything incriminating yet, and probably never would. The veils of Bene Gesserit secrecy were not easily penetrated. He weighed possibilities and options. Reminding the Landsrad that a Bene Gesserit sat by his side might be to his advantage after all, especially as he stepped up his aggressions against spice hoarders. I shall consider it. Anirul snapped her fingers and motioned toward an arched doorway, where two sisters appeared from the hall shadows directing four stout male pages as they carried a throne into the audience chamber. Obviously of substantial weight, the chair was smaller than the Emperor's, but constructed of the same translucent blue-green Hagal quartz. The Emperor spilled spice coffee on his carmine robe as he lurched to his feet. Anirul, I am about to conduct important business. And I should be at your side. This will take only a moment. She pointed to two more pages who walked behind the throne. Frustrated, he examined the dark stain seeping into his robe and tossed the china cup behind him, where it tinkled into shards on the checkerboard floor. Perhaps this would be the best time after all, since his announcement was sure to cause an uproar. Still, he hated to let Anirul win. Panting, the pages set the second throne on the polished stone floor with a thump, then lifted it again to carry it up the wide steps. "Not on the top platform," Shaddam said, in a voice that allowed no compromise. "Place my wife's seat on the level below mine, to the left." Anirul wouldn't get everything she wanted, no matter how she tried to manipulate him. She gave him a small smile, which somehow made him feel petty. "Of course, my husband." She stepped back to scrutinize the arrangement and nodded in satisfaction. "Yvette was a Hagal, you know, and had her seat made to match Elrud's. We can catch up on family history later." Shaddam shouted for an attendant to bring him a fresh robe. A servant cleaned up the broken china cup, making only minimal sounds. In her skirts, Anirul sat on her new throne like an imperial peahen settling into a nest. "I believe we are ready to entertain your visitors now." She smiled at Shaddam, but he maintained a stern countenance as he shrugged into a fresh robe, a deep blue one this time. Shaddam nodded to Redondo. "Let the proceedings begin." The Chamberlain called for the frieze-plated gold doors to be swung open, on hinges that could have been used for highliner cargo hatches. Shaddam did his best to ignore Anirul. Men in cloaks, robes, and formal suits streamed through the archway into the audience chamber. These invited observers represented the most powerful families in the Imperium, as well as a few lesser houses known to hold enormous illegal melange stockpiles. As they took their positions against purple velvet half-walls, many seemed intrigued by Anirul's unexpected presence on the dais. Shaddam spoke without rising. "Watch and learn." He raised a ring-bedecked hand, and the narrow armor-plaz windows around the upper ceiling became opaque. The glow-globes dimmed, and hollow images appeared in the cleared space in front of the massive crystal throne. Even Anirul had not seen the images before. "This is all that remains of the cities of Zanovar," he said in an ominous tone. A blackened wasteland appeared, recorded by automated Sardaukar surveillance cameras that cruised over the bubbling slag. The horrified audience gasped at images of melted structures, lumps that might have been trees, vehicles, or fused together bodies. and craters that could have once been lakes. Steam rose everywhere, and fires smoldered. Twisted skeletons of buildings thrust upward like broken fingernails into a soot-smeared sky. Shaddam had specifically asked Zoom Garon to take images of the charred estate of Tyros Repha. Seeing the devastation, he no longer had any concerns about Elrud's secret bastard son. Acting in accordance with long-established imperial law, we have confiscated a large illegal melange stockpile. House Talagari is guilty of crimes against the Imperium, so their fiefholding of Zanavar has paid the ultimate price. Shaddam let the audience absorb this shocking information. He smelled the terror of the noblemen and ambassadors. The obscure imperial edict against stockpiling dated back thousands of years. Initially, it had applied only to the holder of the Arrakis fief, to prevent that house from embezzling spice and avoiding imperial taxes. Later, the reasons for the edict were broadened, as some noblemen became fabulously wealthy from manipulation of their hordes, starting wars or using spice to take economic and political action against other houses. After centuries of strife surrounding this issue, all great and minor houses were finally required to work cooperatively through the universal conglomerate Choam. Specific language was drafted into the imperial code, detailing the amount of spice that any person or organization could possess. While the images continued to play, a single bright glow globe flickered on at the base of the Golden Lion throne. In the pool of light, an imperial crier read a prepared statement, so that Shaddam did not need to speak the words himself. "Know all that Padishah Emperor Shaddam Corino IV will no longer tolerate illegal spice stockpiling and will enforce the code of imperial law. Every house, great and minor, will be audited by Choam in cooperation with the Spacing Guild. All outlawed spice hordes not voluntarily surrendered will be rooted out, wherever they are, and the perpetrators punished severely. Witness Zanavar. Let all be warned." In the low illumination, Shaddam maintained his stony expression. He watched the panicked expressions on the faces of the representatives. Within hours, they would race back to their home worlds to comply, fearing his next reprisal. Let them tremble. As the parade of horrific images continued in the air, Anirul studied her husband. She had a closer vantage now, with no need to stand in the shadows. The Emperor had been extraordinarily tense lately, preoccupied with something more significant than his usual games of intrigue and court politics. Recently, something important had changed. For years, Anirul had waited and observed in the patient manner of a Bene Gesserit, gathering and interpreting tidbits of information. Long ago she had heard of Project Amal, but hadn't known what it meant. Just a fragment picked up when she'd walked in on a conversation between Shaddam and Count Fenring. Upon seeing her, the men had fallen silent, and the stricken looks on their faces revealed much. She had held her silence and kept her ears open. Finally, the remaining glow globes brightened, and the ion torches were lit on either side of the dais, diluting the still-playing images of blasted Zanavar. For comparison, lush and green promotional images of the planet's former beauty were projected beside the horrible devastation. Shaddam had never been a man for subtlety or restraint. Before the audience could erupt into an uproar, two squads of Sardaukar marched forward. They stood at attention around the perimeter of the room, a chilling punctuation mark to the Emperor's startling ultimatum. Now he gazed dispassionately out on the assemblage, assessing the guilt or innocence he perceived in their faces. With his advisers, he would study recorded images later. to see what could be learned from the reactions of these representatives. From this moment forward, the Landsrad would fear him. No doubt he had also thrown Anirul's own plan into confusion, whatever it was. At least he hoped so. But it didn't really matter. Even without the support of the Bene Gesserit, Shaddam would soon have his Amal. Then he would need no one else. Blood is thicker than water, but politics is even thicker than blood. Elrud the Ninth, Memoirs of Imperial Rule. Fabled Artesia, the capital of House Talagari, became a center of anguish, outrage, and demands for answers. The beloved docent Glax Othan, who normally spoke for Talagari in matters of state, had been murdered in the blatant attack against the fief world of Zanovar. Tyros Repha knew it. He had seen the horrific images. Now House Talagari reeled in shock. Governmental functionaries stumbled over each other in an attempt to formulate a unified response to the outrage. 5 major Zanovar cities had been obliterated, plus several surrounding estates. The open-air Senate Colosseum was a cacophony of wails, shouted questions, and declarations of vengeance. Repha stood unnoticed on a high tier, dressed in the same rumpled clothes he had worn for 3 days now, ever since learning the terrible news. His old teacher had been correct in his fears and suspicions, though Repha had not taken them seriously. Nothing remained for him on Zanovar. While he had a few accounts and investments on Talagari, his estate, his gardens, and staff had been obliterated in a puff of steam, just like the docent. Alarmed Talagari emissaries had gathered inside the Senate Colosseum from the 8 remaining Talagari planets. Near panic filled the air, an unruly and outraged crowd of citizens who felt helplessness and despair at the slaughter. All eyes focused on the lead senator as he stepped to the imaging and loudspeaker podium, flanked by a pair of dour-looking representatives from other major Talagari worlds. Because of his secret heritage, Tyros Repha had studiously avoided any participation in politics. Still, he knew nothing would be accomplished here today. The politicians would bluster and deflect questions. In the end, formal complaints would amount to nothing. Shaddam Corino did not care. A tall man of commanding presence, the lead senator had a moon-like face and an expressive mouth. "Zanovar is lost," he began in the most somber of tones, his tenor voice carrying over the speaker system. He moved his hands in a variety of gestures that expanded upon his words. "Every person here has lost friends or family members in this heinous attack." Among the Talagari people, it was traditional for gathered delegates and even common citizens to make public queries of their senators and to receive immediate answers. The people shouted, producing an overlapping drone of demands and questions. Would the Talagarian military respond? How could they possibly hope to fight the Sardaukar, who had the power to lay waste to an entire world? Were other Talagari planets in danger? "But why did this happen?" a man called out. "How could our emperor commit such an atrocity?" Repha stood cold and speechless. "Because of me. They came because of me. The emperor wanted to kill me, but he tried to cover it up with this monstrous excess." The senator lifted a message cube in the air. "Emperor Shaddam IV charges us with crimes against the Imperium and claims responsibility. Claims credit, in fact, for Zanovar. He has acted as our judge, jury, and executioner. He claims to have meted out appropriate punishment because we kept a private stockpile of melange." Grumbles of anger. howls of disbelief. All houses of the Landsrad maintained reservoirs of spice, just as most families retained their own stockpiles of atomics, which were forbidden to use, though not technically illegal to keep. Another senator stepped forward. "I believe Shaddam is using us as an example for the rest of the Imperium." "Why did my children have to die?" a tall woman shouted. "They had nothing to do with spice stockpiling." "Your children died because Shaddam does not like the fact that I was born," Repha thought. "I got in his way. And he thought nothing of slaying millions just to kill one man. And even so, he missed the target." The lead senator's voice broke with emotion, then grew strong with anger. "Centuries ago, the Emperor's forefather, Hayek Corino II, granted House Tatagari a holding of 9 planets, including Zanavar. We have records showing that Emperor Elrud IX even visited the amusement park and joked about the smell of spice near the sandworm. It was no secret." Questions continued to pour in, and the senators made a gallant effort to field them. Why, after all these years, was this happening? Why had there been no warning? What could be done about the injustice now? In the upper tier, silent during the flurry of demands, Repha simply listened. He had come to Artesia just for the suspenser opera, had been away from Zanavar thanks to a glimmer of the old docent's foresight. Now, having heard the tissue-thin excuses the Emperor used, he didn't believe them for a moment. His revered teacher had always told him, "If stated reasons don't sit well with your conscience or stand the test of logic, look for deeper motivations." He had seen scans taken by unmanned probes flying over the crisped landscape, knew that his own estate had been one of the first targets in the devastation of the planet. Had loyal old Charence even seen the flame front coming his way? Repha's stomach burned as if he had swallowed a hot coal. No one noticed him, just another man in the crowd. He recalled the blackened scar that remained of his home. "Shaddam probably believes he has succeeded, too. He thinks I am dead." Repha stood wearing an enraged expression on his handsome, chisel-featured face. Only once did he move, to wipe a tear from his cheek. Before the interminable public briefing reached its conclusion, he slipped out a side doorway, climbing down the sloping marble staircase, and melted into the anonymity of the city. He had the remnants of his fortune, still a good deal of money. He had the complete freedom of movement afforded to one whom the Imperium thought dead. And now he had nothing to lose. "I am a scorpion under a rock. Now that my half-brother has disturbed me, he had better beware of my sting." Either by design or by some repellent accident of evolution, the Tleilaxu display no admirable qualities. They are abhorrent to look upon. They are generally deceptive, perhaps as part of a genetic imprint. They exude a peculiar odor, like the foul smell of disgusting, rotting food. Because I have had direct dealings with them, perhaps my analysis is not sufficiently objective. But of one fact there can be no doubt. They are extremely dangerous. Thufir Hawat, Atreides Security Commander. Inside a white capsule car approaching the research pavilion, Hidar Fenajidika popped another lozenge into his mouth and chewed it. Such a vile flavor, but necessary to treat his phobia of being underground. He swallowed repeatedly to dissipate the taste, and longed for the glorious sunlight of Thalim that warmed the sacred city of Bandalong. But as soon as he escaped here, Ajitika would have his own world filled with faithful, devout subjects, pursuant to the revelations he had received. His race had strayed from the sacred path, but he would put them back on it. I am the one true messenger of God. On its track, the capsule approached a wall of Armorplaz windows. Through them, he glimpsed the Sardaukar installations that provided security for the complex. Their rigorous protocols kept prying eyes away and permitted Ajitika to perform his work. The capsule came to a stop without incident, and he took a creaking lift tube down to the main level. After decades of necessary purges, finding technicians qualified to work on complex technology had become exceedingly difficult. The master researcher had always preferred simpler systems where fewer things could go wrong. He heard the lift doors clunk shut behind him. A pale-skinned man lumbered up to the lift tube, his face smashed in, his broken body poorly reassembled onto a machine puppet form. These Bi-Ixians were one of Ajitika's own developments, a creative diversion that enabled him to utilize the bodies of executed interrogation victims. Ah, efficiency. The horrific marionettes served to warn the restive population against rebellion. The monstrosities also performed mundane tasks, cleaning up, disposing of toxic wastes and chemicals. Unfortunately, the hybrid creatures failed to function reliably, but he kept making changes to improve them. Ajitika passed through a bioscanner doorway that identified him by his cellular structure, then entered a room the size of a spacecraft hangar, where the new axolotl tanks were kept. White-smocked laboratory assistants worked at instrument-laden tables. They glanced nervously at him and increased the intensity of their efforts. The air smelled metallic, scrubbed clean with chemicals and disinfectants, and over it all hung a thick and distinctive cinnamon scent, reminiscent of melange. Amal. Coffin-sized containers held fertile women, their higher brain functions destroyed, their reflexes and senses shut down. Axolotl tanks. Nothing more than bloated wombs. Biological factories far more sophisticated than any machine ever built by a human hand. Even back on their primary worlds, the Beni Tlaloks grew their golas and face dancers inside these tanks. No one had ever seen a Tlaloksu woman, because none existed. Any mature female was converted into an axolotl tank and was used to reproduce the chosen race. For years, the Tlaloksu had quietly harvested women from the captive Ixian populace. Many thousands had died so that Ajitika could modify them to produce new substances that were biochemically similar to melange. Using the subtle language of genetics and mutations, these axolotl tanks exuded Amal, and finally, Ajitamal, the master researcher's secret of secrets. He wrinkled his nose at the smell of the bodies, an unpleasant female odor. Tubes and wires linked each fleshy, turgid container to pulsing diagnostic instruments. He no longer saw the axolotl tanks as human. Even in the beginning, they had only been women. At the center of the room, two research assistants moved aside as Ajitika approached a special tank, the enhanced womb of a captured spy, the Bene Gesserit Miral Aleikum. When caught attempting an act of sabotage, she had resisted divulging any information, even under severe torture. But the master researcher had known methods of extracting the truth before converting her to his own purposes. And, to his delight, Miral proved to have more capability as an axolotl tank than any of the Ixian stock. After so much time, the witch's skin had taken on an orange cast. A receptacle connected to her neck contained a liter of clear liquid, her newly synthesized product. When pumped through her Bene Gesserit systems, the Amal she exuded was different from that produced by any other tank. Ajitamal. Miral Alekum, we have a mystery. How can I adapt the other tanks to accomplish what you do? Her flat, spiritless eyes flickered slightly, and deep within their pupils he thought he detected terror and unbridled rage. But with her vocal cords dead and her mind lost, she could not respond. Thanks to Tleilaxu technology, this womb could be forced to live for centuries. With her mind destroyed, even suicide was impossible for her. Soon, when he and his face dancer minions departed from Xuta, Ajitika would take this valuable axolotl tank to a safe planet. Perhaps he could obtain a few more Bene Gesserit captives to see if something about them made the best tanks. He had only this one, and through stimulants he had already pumped up her production levels as high as possible. Ajitika clipped an extraction device to the receptacle and drained the liter of synthetic spice into a container, which he took with him. For several days now he had ingested a great deal of Ajitamal and experienced no deleterious after-effects, only pleasant sensations. So he intended to take more, much more. Pulse racing, he hurried into his office and sealed the identity screens and defensive systems behind him. Dropping into a chair dog, he waited for the mindless sedentary animal to conform to his body. Finally, he tilted his head back and gulped the warm, slick Ajitamal, fresh from the flow of Alekum's body, like milk from a cow. He had never before consumed so much at once. A sudden, violent fit of coughing came over him, and his stomach tried to cast out the substance in an acid upheaval. Spilling the rest of the container onto the floor, he rolled out of the twitching chair dog and doubled over. His face contorted, muscles stretched and tore. Yellow fluids poured from his mouth, vile-smelling food remnants. But his system had already absorbed the fast-acting substance. He tumbled into euphoric convulsions that escalated until he longed for the welcome serenity of unconsciousness. Had the Bene Gesserit witch poisoned him? He clung to a furious need for revenge. With fierce Tleilaxu methods, he was sure he could make even a dreaming axolotl tank feel pain. Countless agony-infused moments passed, until he felt a shift in the microcosm that made up his tortured mind and body. Diminished, or perhaps his nerves had already been burned into cinders. Surfacing from the nightmarish misery, Ajitika opened his eyes. He found himself on the floor of his office, with shigawire spools, film books, and sample trays scattered and broken around him, as if he had flown into a mindless frenzy. The chair dog cowered in the corner, its fur ragged and pliable bones twisted and torn. The stench of his bile was overwhelming. Even his body and clothes reeked. Nearby, an overturned chronometer revealed that an entire day had passed. I should be hungry or thirsty. The stench robbed him of any such inclination, but not the rage that had kept him alive. With his long-fingered hands, he located the flat shard of a broken tray and scooped up a sample of his own vomit, which had coagulated into bead-shaped chunks. As he hurried back onto the lab floor, Sardaukar guards and research assistants gave him a wide berth. Despite his high status, they wrinkled their noses as he passed. He marched straight to the Miral Alekum tank, intending to hurl the bile into her face and inflict her with unimaginable indignities, though she would never know what was happening. The tank's large female eyes stared dispassionately, without focus. With a sudden rush, new sensations and thoughts washed through his mind, an alien experience that blasted open mental blockades he had not even known existed. Vast quantities of data poured through his brain. A side effect of the overdose of Ajitamal? He saw the axolotl tanks around him in a new light. For the first time, he realized clearly that he could link every one of the tanks to the Elecum unit, so that all of them would produce the precious substance. With clear insight, he saw how it could all fit together, and what adjustments he would need to make. Off to one side, he noticed laboratory technicians watching with their dark little eyes, whispering among themselves. Several of them skittered away, but he shouted, "Come over here, immediately!" Though clearly alarmed at the bloodshot madness in his eyes, they complied. With just an assessing glance, as if each new thought were a revelation, Ejitika realized that two of these scientists would be better suited to other duties. How could he not have noticed this before? The tiniest remembered actions came to him now, petite perceptions he had been too busy to notice previously. Now it all signified something. Amazing! For the first time in his life, Ejitika's eyes were completely open. His mind could now chronicle every action he'd seen, every word these men had uttered in his presence. All of the information lined up in his mind, as if he were a pre-Butlerian computer. More data streamed into his brain through open floodgates, bits and pieces from every person Ejitika had ever met. He remembered everything. But how was this happening, and why? The Ejitimal. Lightning passage from the Sufi Buddhist-Islamic credo came to him. To achieve Satori, no understanding is needed. Satori exists without words, without even a name. It had all happened in an instant, a glimmer of cosmic time. Ejitika no longer noticed the odor or taste of his own bile, for that was on a physical plane, and he had attained a higher state of consciousness. The large dose of artificial spice had opened untapped regions of his mind. In a blinding new vision, he beheld the path to his own eternal salvation, by the grace of God. He was now more convinced than ever that he would lead the Bene Tlaloks to holy glory. At least, those worth saving. Anyone who thought differently would die. "Master Ejitika," a tremulous voice said, "are you feeling well?" Opening his eyes, he saw research assistants hovering around him, showing concern mixed with fear. Only one man had found the nerve to speak up. Using his heightened powers of observation, Ejitika knew that this was a person who could be trusted, one who would serve well in his new regime. Rising to his feet, still holding the chunks of vomit on the shard of broken tray, Ejitika said, "You are Blin, third assistant operator of Tank 57.
"That is correct, Master. Do you require medical assistance?"
"We must perform God's work," Ejitika said. Blin bowed.
"So I learned at an early age."
He appeared confused, but from his body language, Ejitika could tell that he wanted desperately to please his superior. With a smile that revealed sharp teeth, Ejitika said, "Hereafter, you are second in command of my research facility, reporting only to me." Blin's dark eyes blinked in surprise. He squared his shoulders.
"I will serve in any capacity you command, sir."
Hearing a gasp of displeasure from one of the other scientists, Ejitika hurled the sample of bile at the man. "You! Clean my office and replace everything that's broken. You have 4 hours to complete the work. If you fail, it will be Blin's first assignment to fit you with an apparatus to make you the first male axolotl tank." Consumed with terror, the man hurried away. Ejitika smiled down at Mirella Lakem, a motionless hulk of repulsive naked flesh in a coffin-shaped container. Despite his enhanced abilities, he could not be certain if the Bene Gesserit spy had truly attempted to harm him, even with her buried subconscious. She did not seem aware of anything. Now Ejitika knew that God was watching over him, a mighty presence that guided him on the path to the great belief, the only true path. His destiny was clear. Despite the pain he had suffered, the overdose had been a blessing. One can never separate politics from the economics of Melange. They have walked hand in hand throughout imperial history. Shaddam Corino IV, Preliminary Memoirs. An excited spotter in Redwall Siege summoned Liet Kynes to the hidden observation post high on the rugged ridge. He ascended through perilous shafts and hidden cracks, finding hand and toe holds until he reached an exposed ledge. The air smelled like burned gunpowder. "I see a man approaching, even in the heat of day." The spotter was a grinning boy with a weak chin and an eager smile. "Someone alone." Intrigued, Liet followed the wiry, wide-eyed youth into the dry heat. Thermal currents shimmered from the red and black lava buttresses that thrust like a citadel from the dunes. "I have summoned Stilgar as well." The spotter was full of anticipation. "Good. Still has the best eyes among us." Instinctively, Liet inserted plugs into his nostrils. His still suit was new, replacing the one the Emperor's guards had clumsily ruined. Liet shaded his eyes from the glare of the lemon-yellow sky and stared across the undulating ocean of sand. "I am surprised Shai Hulud hasn't taken him." He discerned a tiny speck, a moving figure that appeared no larger than an insect. "The lone man in the desert is a dead man."
"That one may be a fool, Eat, but he is not dead yet."
Turning at the voice, he saw Stilgar approaching from behind. The hawkish man knew how to move with silence and grace.
"Should we go help him, or kill him?"
The spotter's piping voice was emotionless, trying to impress these two great men.
"We can take his water for the tribe."
Stilgar extended a sinewy hand, and the boy passed him an oft-repaired set of binoculars that had once belonged to planetologist Pardut Kynes. Liet suspected the desert wanderer might be a lost member of a Harkonnen troop, an exiled villager, or some idiotic prospector. After focusing the delicate oil lenses, Stilgar reacted with surprise.
"He moves like a Fremen, walks without pattern, his steps irregular."
He increased the magnification, then lowered the binoculars.
"Uruk. And he is either injured or exhausted."
Liet reacted immediately. "Stilgar, summon a rescue party. Go save him if you can. I would rather have his story than his water." When they brought Turok in, his still suit was torn, his shoulder and right arm wounded, though the blood had coagulated. He had lost his left Temag boot, causing the still suit pumps to cease functioning. Though he'd just been given water, Turok had reached the limit of human endurance.